In 1912, he was the US Open champion for the second year. He won it at Buffalo. And he went over to Muirfield, one of the most famous courses in the world, and certainly one of the most famous courses in the Open Championship. And he was strongly fancied. In those days, you had 36-hole qualifiers before you got into the tournament proper. He shot 91. He couldn't adapt at all. He played poorly. He was upset. He was angry. This 91 had people over there laughing at him, including journalists who were quite happy to see him fail, because of the fact that he was seen already as being a sort of a cocky guy who was going to put the British players in their place. The following year, in 1913, before Brookline, he played in the Open Championship at Hoylake near Liverpool. And he played well. He finished fifth. And at that stage, that was the best ever showing by an American player. And in those days, you've got to remember, you had to get a boat journey to cross the Atlantic and get yourself prepared. And he was well prepared on both occasions, but the first one, awful. The second one, not bad at all.
Hi, this is Rich Weil from Somers, New York, and I play at the Mohansic Golf Course. Brought to you by MyGolfingStore.com, this is Golf Smarter number 847.
A U.S. Open history lesson that will surprise you despite what you've seen in the movies with author Kevin Kenny.
This is Golf Smarter, sharing stories, tips, and insights from great golf minds to help you lower your score and raise your golf IQ. Here's your host, Fred Green.
Welcome to the Golf Smarter podcast, Kevin.
Hello, Fred. Nice to meet you.
It's great to have you on the show. I'm so happy that this book was recommended to me by a good friend. And it's a fascinating story that most golf fans probably aren't aware of, and that is the first American, how do they say, the first American homebred hero.
Oh, yes, exactly, yes.
Yeah, to win the U.S. Open, and that's why we're doing that this week, is because the U.S. Open's coming up. It's a time for a history lesson. Introduce us, please, if you will, to John McDermott.
Well, he was from Philadelphia, of Irish-American stock, father a mailman, and he started his life in golf by caddying at Aronimink, which is one of America's most famous golf courses, host of major championships, both professional and amateur. And he learned the game by caddying there. And then at a relatively young age of about 17, he turned professional. That was the norm, I think, for the way. You've got to remember at these times that a lot of people saw golf professionals in that era as caddies, or maybe slightly better than caddies. And there was only very, very few people that sort of achieved sort of a more significant place in society than that. So he came through the ranks, but he clearly had talent. And he started out by playing in the US Open, but it was really the years between 1910 to 1913 that he became an extremely famous and successful player.
I'm going to stop you for a moment because I want to dig in a little bit. When you said he turned professional at age 17, what is that in 19? What year was he born?
He was born. He was 19. He was born in about 1891, 1892, around that year, around that time.
Yeah. Okay. So, in 1910, yeah. What does it mean to be turned professional in golf?
It's a good question, because there was no formal path into it. You just said, "I'm going to become a professional, and I'm going to make from teaching or selling clubs." That was it. So you graduated from the caddy yard usually, and you just said, "I'm going," and you tried to get somebody to give you a job as an assistant, which he did. And that got him on his path.
And up to that moment, how old was golf in the United States? When did golf get going in the United States?
Well, professional golf and golf generally, but the 1890s, last decade.
So it was a relatively new sport.
relatively new, and most of the certainly in the professional world, most of the big hitters in golf came from Britain, mostly Scotland. When I say the big hitters, the players, the course designers like Donald Ross, not exclusively, but an awful lot of the, if you can call them elites of that time, they came across from Scotland to earn a living. They knew that the game was beginning to blossom in America. There were opportunities. America was a relatively wealthy, powerful country at that stage. And golf was beginning to take off. And, of course, they dominated golf for the first 10, 15 years in terms of establishing golf clubs, in terms of designing courses, and particularly in terms of playing. And that's why before John McDermott won the US Open for the first time in 1911, no American-born player was dominated by mostly Scots and a few English professionals who had come over to make a living.
And this is all pre-World War One.
Absolutely. Right?
Yeah.
And
they're seeing this. So there was an attraction to come to the United States to play golf as teachers, not as a touring professional competitor.
Really a tour as such. There was the US Open and maybe a few other tournaments, but they were teaching. There were also a lot of challenge matches at that time where pros would challenge each other. You know, they'd maybe get somebody to put up a purse for a challenge match. There'd be bets on it, that type of thing. But the main attraction was to get a good club, to get one of the more prestigious clubs. And if you had a Scottish accent, it helped.
Is that right?
No doubt about it. And the newspapers commented on that a lot, about the Scottish brogue, or the Scotch brogue, as the journalists might have called it, that if you had the Scotch brogue, you had a better chance. It automatically meant this guy knows something about golf.
Interesting.
So McDermott resented this terribly. He felt that the American pros were being treated as inferior species by the imports. Now, some of that may have been not true, but there was also some truth in it as well. So mm-hmm. There was a little divide between the homebreds and the imports, but definitely being an import helped you get along in professional golf at that time.
Fascinating. And these challenge matches, were they noticed by anybody? Was it like the horse races where you're just like, oh, let's go out and watch the horses and bet on the horses?
Yeah, well, no, they would have been set up. There would have been quite an anticipation about them, you know, in the various clubs that they were played in. One pro would challenge another, or two pros would challenge another two into a four ball. Being noticed, they would have got a little bit of coverage in the press. Because, see, there weren't an awful lot of tournaments to report on. But John McDermott, when he came on the scene, even when he was young, before he was known, he was challenging people for $500, which was a huge amount of money. Mm. This would have been about 1909, 1910. He was throwing down the gauntlet and say, I'll take on anyone for $500. I don't know where he got the money. But it's not recorded. Maybe he had some backers. But he was very, very good at that, very, very confident in his own ability.
And when we back up a full century and you say it was covered in the press, it's hard for us to fathom what the press was in the early 1900s versus the early 2000s, where we had complete coverage all over the world, everywhere, instantaneously.
24/7, absolutely. A lot of the newspapers, the Philadelphia Inquirer, local newspapers, they would pick up on these matches. They would hear about them. They would report. You'd get a few lines in the paper. Now, nothing like the US Open. That was the big one. That got proper coverage, day by day, et cetera, et cetera. But the challenge matches, they were just somebody would hear about it or phone in about it and so on, and they would get a few lines in the paper. It would get your name, maybe a small headline. But McDermott was very, very confident in his own, and he was a very good money player with his own money.
And so the Open Championship, which we call the British Open, we do over here. That was well established at that point, right? I mean, Open Championship been around for a while?
Oh, absolutely. Ryan McDermott's time was around for 40, 50 years. That was well established. But the US Open, that was the one where McDermott that's where he really featured. But the British Open was around a long, long time before that.
Do you have any sense of when the U.S. Open began and how its origins?
I'm not sure who started it, but I think the first U.S. Open was around about, I can check it if you like. It was about 1891, I think. Let's see.
Just about the time that that McDermott was born.
1895, I beg your pardon.
Okay, 1895. So he was a little kid.
He was about 30 years old.
And was that in the Philadelphia area?
No, I don't know. I'm not quite sure where the first one was. I can check it if you like, but it started 1895, won by an Englishman called Horace Rollins. You're absolutely right. That was just McDermott was just a few years old when that started.
Right. And so for the first 15, 20 years of the U.S. Open, it was always dominated by Brits or Scots.
First 16 years, it was always a British or a Scottish, well, an English or a Scottish winner.
Great English. Yeah. Yeah.
Mostly Scots.
All right. Well, let's talk more about this who John McDermott was versus who we think he was. But we're going to take a quick time out and we'll be right back after this. This episode of the Golf Smarter podcast is brought to you by mygolfingstore.com, home of the Eagle Eye Rangefinder. Let's talk about the Eagle Eye Rangefinder. Actually, it's my favorite rangefinder, and it has all the premium features you need, like slope technology, an 800-yard range, and flagpole lock vibrating sensor. Yet, it's a fraction of the cost of all the overpriced rangefinders out there. And it's so easy to use. Just raise the rangefinder to your eye and find the pin. The Eagle Eye will automatically lock onto the target, even, like me, if you have shaky hands. And then it will vibrate when the laser has locked onto the pin. And I have to tell you, this is my favorite feature because over the years, I've used a lot of different rangefinders and I've always had the same problem with each of them. I couldn't get a clear reading because my hands were shaking while I was trying to focus on it. With my Eagle Eye rangefinder, I just click once and it locks on the target every time. Now, here's the best part. Usually, the Eagle Eye rangefinder retails for $259.97. However, we've put together a special 50% off deal for Golf Smarter listeners. That means you can get the Eagle Eye rangefinder right now for the ridiculously low price of only $129. Just go to mygolfingstore.com/golfsmarter. Again, that's mygolfingstore.com/golfsmarter, or click on the link at golfsmarter.com. And I'll also put the link in today's show notes. However, I do need to warn you that this is a limited time deal and it won't last long. So go to mygolfingstore.com/golfsmarter and secure your rangefinder while you still can. Kevin, I think that most people, if they're golf historians at all, and you say, who won the very first U.S. Open? Who's the first American-born golfer to win the U.S. Open? The name Francis Ouimet would probably come up to most people.
For sure.
And of course, Ouimet won it in what was it? He won it a couple of years in a row. 1913. But that wasn't the first one. It was John McDermott.
John McDermott was the first one 2 years before. In 1910, John McDermott tied for the U.S. Open in a playoff with two Scottish brothers, the Smith brothers, Alex Smith and MacDonald Smith, and he lost in the playoff. And then in 1911, he won it in the playoff, and in 1912, he won it again. So for 3 years, over 72 holes, nobody beat his score. And then it was Francis Ouimet then in 1913, as you say, who won maybe the most famous or one of the most famous U.S. Opens of all time.
And that was the one at Brookline, right?
That was the one at Brookline, immortalized in book and in by Walt Disney movies as well. The greatest game ever played.
So why is it that John McDermott is getting slighted? Why isn't his story that compelling?
I think there are a few reasons. First of all, if we start at 1913 and work backwards, Francis we met was a caddy. He was a caddy boy from Boston, but he beat Harry Vardon and Ted Ray in a playoff. He was completely unknown, and he beat these two giants of the game in a playoff and literally put golf in America onto the front pages. Also, he was a very, very charming, respectful, nice guy, whereas McDermott, who had won the previous two Opens, was fiery. Some people said cocky. And had attitude, as we'll probably talk about later on. And his attitude boiled to the surface famously in 1913, just before the Brookline US Open. So I think those reasons, the personalities are two, but also the fact that we met was this completely unknown caddy, and the fact that he beat Vardon and Ray, who were two. It was one thing for an American born guy to win the US Open, but to beat the British, who were the superior, it was their game after all, to beat the British at their own game was just something unheard of. It gave the country a tremendous lift. And whereas McDermott's career sadly tapered away, but Francis we met became this great figure in American golf, in American life. He had a postage stamp dedicated to him and many other honours.
Unbelievable. So wait, when McDermott won in 1910, or actually when he tied in 1910 with the Smith brothers, they weren't Americans, were they?
They were Scottish from up around Carnoustie way on the east coast of Scotland, yeah.
And so what was he building up the excitement? Was McDermott building up the excitement for those 3 years and then just disappeared?
Well, he disappeared. I'm not sure chronologically, which way you want to do this. I mean, he came on the scene really in 1910 at the Philadelphia Cricket Club, and he tied the Smith brothers. Mm-hmm. And people began to take interest because he too was a caddy, but he was a professional as well. And there was a certain amount of snobbery. I think if we're being honest about it, I think a lot of the public and probably the media as well, they preferred an amateur caddy to a professional ex-caddy or an ex-caddy now professional. So the media were definitely getting interested in him at this stage. They were beginning to talk about this caddy boy. He was only 19 when he won his first US Open. So quite remarkable. But he was building up excitement. The newspapers gave him very, very good coverage when he won his two US Opens in a row, but nothing like what followed when Francis we met won it.
Why do you think it is is it just because the path that he took, that he said, I want to be a professional, and he was kind of cocky about it, or the press not like him?
They liked him. He was a very good copy, but they also, deep down, a lot of them felt that he was a bit too cocky. You know, he was he had this famous run-in with Ted Ray and Harry Vardon just the week before the US Open of 1913. And he was pilloried, and I think maybe his career was never quite the same after that.
Was he the year that Ouimet beat Ted Ray and Harry Vardon in 1913? Was McDermott a factor in that championship?
It's a very interesting question. The week before the U.S. Open at Brookline, the week before there was a tournament at Delaware, Shawnee on Delaware, and McDermott, Vardon and Ray were playing in it, and McDermott beat them out of sight. And afterwards, he basically told them that he rubbed it in and said, you know, just so as you know, you're not going to take the US Open trophy back with you because I'm going to beat you. And everybody thought it was deeply insulting to these two giants of the game to talk to them in this way. And it created it was a diplomatic incident, you know, letters flying backwards and forwards from both sides of the Atlantic. And at one stage, the USGA, who sided with Vardon and Ray and the establishment, and they were talking about stopping McDermott from playing at Brookline. But in the event, he played, and actually he played quite well. He only finished four shots behind. Four shots out of a playoff. So it was a good defense of his title. So, he was almost a factor. Four shots is not, in professional golf over 72 holes is not a lot. So he put up a good show. But the effect that it had on him, the amount of abuse that he got, some of it self-inflicted, but the amount of criticism that he received, I think it marked him. He was a fairly paranoid type of guy anyway. So as we'll probably see later on, if we want to talk about his health issues or mental health issues rather, but a lot of people would feel that that was a big turning point. But he was very young. Remember, he was only, what was he, about 22 at the time, you know, so. But there were no allowances made for that.
And how old were Ray and Vardon at that time?
Oh, they would have been well into their 30s. They were experienced players, open championships and the rest. You know what I mean? These were massive figures in golf. But it was more the fact that he was seen as being disrespectful to the masters of the game. And the USGA, the US Golfing Association, did not like that. They reprimanded him as he was rebuked by the media, by just about everybody. The funny thing about it was that actually himself and we met got on well. The day after when the 72 holes ended, there was a playoff, this famous playoff between Vardon, we met, and Ted Ray, and McDermott stayed behind to encourage we met. Give him some advice beforehand. He was so determined that the trophy stayed in America as opposed to across the Atlantic. So he gave him some advice, and we met always recognized that. So they got on fine. Hmm. You know, people might have imagined that there was a sort of an animosity there. It doesn't look like that. Mm-hmm. Matthew was a very generous guy, but McDermott was also quite generous to we met, and he acknowledged that by staying behind, as I say, to support him in the playoff.
Interesting. Hmm. Was the USGA established at this point in the early 1900s?
Yeah, that was established. I'm not sure of the exact date, but it would have been established in the last decade of the 20th century, 1890s.
Okay. And there was
no PGA at that time. There was no Professional Golfers Association. That didn't start in 1916. So the USGA, it still runs the US Open, but it really basically ran golf. So there was no PGA, in a sense, to even defend McDermott or stick up from. So he was pretty much on his own.
And were there established events every year like this, or was it really just the U.S. Open and the Open Championship at that point?
No, there were a number of tournaments. And it's good that you asked that, because an awful lot of people have said that after Brookline, McDermott's career was finished. In fact, a month afterwards, he won the Western Open, which was that had been going for a number of years. And that was after the US Open. That was the next most prestigious event. And he won that. So that was a very, very big event. The Philadelphia Open, which he won three times, that was another event. There was the Metropolitan Open. There was always a tournament down in Pinehurst in North Carolina. So there was, maybe six, seven, eight tournaments. And then you had the challenge matches that I spoke of. But there wasn't a tour. There was nothing like the PGA Tour that began in the 1930s. That hadn't happened yet.
All right. There's so much more that I want to learn about John McDermott and what you alluded to, mental health issues, but also what it was like to be a professional golfer. And we're going to do that right after this. This episode is brought to you by DraftKings Sportsbook. And with two majors down, next up, Brookline. Now, from tee to green, get in on all the action with DraftKings Sportsbook. New customers can deposit $25 or more and get $100 of free bets instantly. So who do you think will be able to tame the country club this weekend? Is it going to be Brooks, Scotty, Justin Thomas? Will Rory be able to roar back and win 2 weeks in a row? Well, not all the big names will be there, but this is for a major. And those who chose to play in an exhibition match won't be competing against the absolute best in the world. Now, it's easy. Just pick six golfers, stay under the salary cap, and lock your lineup before the pros hit the first hole on Thursday. Everyone can play for over $10 million in prizes. Don't miss the action for golf's third major. Download the DraftKings Sportsbook app now. Use code GOLFSMARTER at sign up. deposit $25 or more and get $100 in free bets instantly. That's code GOLFSMARTER only at DraftKings Sportsbook. Minimum age and eligibility restrictions apply. See notes for details. Now, if you or someone you know has a gambling problem, crisis counseling and referral services can be accessed by calling 1-800-GAMBLER. That's 1-800-426-2537 in Illinois, Indiana, Minnesota, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, West Virginia, and Wyoming. Or 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. That's 1-800-522-4700 in Colorado and New Hampshire. 888-789-7777 or visit httpccpg.org/chat in Connecticut. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-877-770-STOP. That's 7867 in Louisiana. 877-8-HOPE-NEW-YORK or text HOPE-NY. 467-369 in New York. Visit opgr.org in Oregon or call text Tennessee Redline 1-800-889-9789 in Tennessee or 1-888-532-3500 in Virginia. 21 years and older or 18 years and older in Wyoming, physically present in Arizona, Colorado, Connecticut, Illinois, Indiana, Iowa, Louisiana, Minnesota, New Jersey, New York, Pennsylvania, Tennessee, Virginia, West Virginia, and Wyoming only. New customers only. Minimum $25 deposit required. Eligibility restrictions apply and product offerings may vary by state. See DraftKings.com/sportsbook for details. Kevin, I'm fascinated about the, you know, what it took to be a professional golfer at this time and to compete on a regular basis, but there wasn't a lot of money. I mean, like, there was no sponsorship money here. And you, if you won $500, that was a tremendous amount of money at that time. But how long did that last, considering you had to cover all your travel expenses and you had to cover everything?
Well, the first prize for the U.S. Open, both U.S. Opens that McDermott won, that was $300. That was the first prize.
Wow.
But there were some add-ons in the sense that one, it could help you get a good club job. Two, and McDermott did this successfully for a while anyway, you could design your own clubs. The clubs then were handmade rather than factory made. And he was very, very good. He was a club maker as well as everything else. So basically that was it. You made some money on the golf course. You made some money from challenge matches and tournaments. You made some money from teaching. And then you made some money from club making. And if you were successful like he was, then it was, you know, quite the thing to say my clubs were made by the U.S. Open champion. So that was it. Not a huge amount of money, but there was something there.
Interesting. And he did McDermott end up competing overseas as well? Did he go after titles at the Open Championship?
Good question. Now, in 1912, he was the U.S. Open champion for the second year. He won it at Buffalo, New York. And he went over to Muirfield, one of the most famous courses in the world, and certainly one of the most famous courses in the Open Championship roster. And he was strongly fancied. And the qualifying, in those days, you had 36-hole qualifiers before you got into the tournament proper. He shot 91 in the first round. He couldn't adapt at all. He played poorly. He was upset. He was angry. He improved in the second round. I think he had an 81 in the second round. But this 91 had people over there laughing at him, and including journalists who were quite happy to see him fail, because of the fact that he was seen already as being a sort of a cocky guy who was going to put the British players in their place. And he shot 91 in the first round. And then he, in fact, he played in the French Open the following week and played well. I think he finished fourth or fifth. The following year, in 1913, the year of Brookline, before Brookline, he played in the Open Championship at Hoylake near Liverpool. And he played well. He finished fifth. And at that stage, that was the best ever showing by an American player. So he had two goes at the Open Championship as a competitor. One awful and one quite respectable. But he was very determined. And in those days, you've got to remember, you had to get a boat journey to whatever length of time it took to cross the Atlantic and get yourself prepared. And he was well prepared on both occasions. But the first one, awful. The second one, not bad at all. But he was keen. He was one of the first to sort of say, yes, I'm one of the first Americans. And he was sponsored for those things. But just when you mentioned about the money, there was actually a collection made from by local, certainly the Boston and Philadelphia Golf Associations, I think, business people, et cetera, they collected money to send him on his way to pay for the trip, because that would have been an expensive trip. You had to go for about a month between traveling there and back and getting some practice rounds in beforehand and so on.
Okay, so the word sponsorship existed, but it was a very different beast.
Very different, exactly.
Interesting. Did you mention Germans didn't like him?
Some journalists.
Oh, journalists. I'm sorry, I thought you said Germans.
Maybe my Irish accent is hard.
No, that's okay. My lack of Irish hearing.
Yeah, they thought he was good copy because he was always in the news, either because he was playing well or because he might have had an argument with somebody or other. But they also were a little bit suspicious of that, but they liked him because he sold newspapers.
And
they played up the boy caddy angle quite a bit.
And had you said he played in the French Open? So,
in the French, on the way back from the Open Championship at Muirfield, a group of him and some of his colleagues from America who had gone over there to compete as well, they played in the French Open, won by a local French player called forgotten his name, but he won. But he played quite respectably there. That was on the way back.
Mm-hmm. So golf went east before it came out west, right? I mean, it traveled through Europe its inception.
France always had a tradition for golf, going right back to sort of the same time as America. Americans took it up. France had a for the elites, I would have thought, but it had a tradition of golf. Further east than that, no, it wasn't like certainly in Central Eastern Europe. You wouldn't have had golf at that stage.
I see. I see. I'm fascinated. What drew you to this story?
I have a good friend in Florida, a man called Marty Cavanaugh. He's a PGA professional, Hall of Fame member. And I met him a few times when I was over in the United States researching. And we emailed from time to time. And he talked to me about John McDermott. And he said to me, because I'd written three books on American golf history. And he said to me, that guy, he said he was really badly treated. And he said, it's really a shame that he's not in the Hall of Fame and all of this. And he said, there's a story there. And I said, I'm not so sure. But anyway, I thought, let's do it. And I did it. So that's really what got me an interest in American golf history, which I've always had. And secondly, then the fact that Marty was prompting me and I got down to it then. So that's it.
And where am I speaking to you today? Where are you today?
I'm in Dublin.
You're in Dublin, Ireland.
Right, the capital of Ireland on the East Coast.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Okay. And you've written other golf books, golf history books.
I've written three golf history books, one about American golf during the Great Depression. I've written a biography of Ralph Guldall, who won the U.S. Open two consecutive years, 1937, 1938. Then he won the Masters the next year. He was the best player in the world. And then within 3 or 4 years, he lost his game. And I've written a bio of Patty Berg, one of the great women golfers and promoters of women's golf, one of the founders of the LPGA Tour that now is this mega million business, if you like. And she was a pioneer. That's the name of the book, Pioneer Champion of Women's Golf. So that's the three, and this is the fourth.
But you clearly have a fascination with American golfers.
Absolutely, yes, absolutely. Why not? So much of it. So many stories, so many different angles, so many wonderful players, just so much going on there. Yeah.
Fascinating.
It's my hobby.
Mm-hmm. It's your hobby. You've written, four books and it's your hobby.
When I wrote a book about Ralph Guldall, who was from Texas, from Dallas, I emailed Ben Crenshaw's office, two-time master champion, and asked him if he would consider maybe writing a testimonial or whatever, which he very kindly agreed to do. And his agent, I think it was his agent or certainly his friend who I was using as an intermediary, said, what in God's name is a guy in Dublin writing a book about Ralph Guldolf in Dallas, Texas. So there we are. So I suppose it is a bit strange, but as I say, it's a hobby. That's it.
Oh, wow. All right. Well, we're speaking with author Kevin Kenny, who is written, he's fascinated by American golf from Dublin, and he's from Dublin, Ireland. But we're going to talk more about his book, Golf's Forgotten Hero, The Life of John McDermott, as we approach the U.S. Open, the very first American homebred hero to win the U.S. Open on the week of the U.S. Open. And we're going to be back right after this. This week on Golf Smarter Mulligans, we talked to Craig Sigal of Break80Golf.com on how you can achieve lower scores without practicing.
Here's the easiest, simplest thing in the world. As part of your pre-shot routine, you have an idea or a trigger to smile. I'm going to smile 18 times today. That's my main goal. All sports psychologists talk about process goals. Have ones that contribute to your emotional framework for the day. Emotions are there for a reason. Your unconscious mind lets you know whether or not you are or are not living to your values and your beliefs. So if your value out there for playing golf is to score only, then if you don't, you're going to get difficult emotions. What if you start the round with my goal, my belief, my value right now is to enjoy the heck out of myself. You're out there to enjoy the sun. You're out there to enjoy the grass, the feel of a crisp stroke coming right off the center of a 5-iron. If you're out there on the course thinking that, come on, can you just see how your game is going to be better?
That's Golf Smarter Mulligans, episode 163, featuring Craig Sigal. So please, along with your subscription to Golf Smarter, subscribe to Golf Smarter Mulligans, the best of the Golf Smarter archives that are no longer available on any podcast app, published every Friday from wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts. So John McDermott's path was unique. He ruffled some feathers along the way because of his confidence and arrogance and cockiness. But he also backed it up by winning.
Oh, he could play.
He won the U.S. Open 2 years in a row. And then Francis Ouimet wins the next U.S. Open, again, beating the masters of the game, Ted Ray and Harry Vardon. But what happened then to John McDermott? He disappeared from the conversation.
Yes. I mean, if you go up to 1913, where he was still very much a feature, even though he didn't win the U.S. Open, make it a hat-trick, but he won the Western Open, and he was still very much a feature. But after that, gradually, mental health problems began to take over his life, and he more or less withdrew or was withdrawn from life, and he ended up in I think what was called or what is called, I beg your pardon, schizophrenia. That's what it was diagnosed with, but. He was assigned to an asylum in Pennsylvania called Norristown because he had a breakdown. That may be a simplistic way of putting it, of calling, because I'm sure it was far more complex than that. But from all the evidence available, he had a form of breakdown and was diagnosed as being schizophrenic. Now, what caused the breakdown? There are various reports on that. He made some investments, apparently, around about 1913, when he had accumulated a decent amount of money for the time. Apparently, they went badly for him. But he also had got some serious issues of paranoia, which, as I understand, was one of the symptoms of schizophrenia. He felt that people were out to get him. He felt the USGA were after him because of what happened just prior to the US Open when they were considering banning him. He felt he was misunderstood. And basically from 1916 onwards, he lived the rest of his days up to 1971 in an institution. And it's interesting that the PGA of America was formed in 1916, and at the very, very first meeting in New York, a collection was made for John McDermott. And to be fair to his fellow professionals like Gene Sarazen and Walter Hagen, they organized testimonial matches for him to raise some funds to help him with the upkeep in the sanatorium. Sarazen, Hagen, Johnny Farrell, Irish-American professional, won the US Open in the 1920s. So there was a fair amount of support. And they never, Walter Hagen visited him at Norristown. They never forget the fact that he was the first. He opened the gates for them. He was the first one that gave the US professionals the confidence. Before McDermott, no homebred American had won the US Open. After his second victory, the next five were won by Americans. Now, that's hardly coincidence. So there was a sort of a pioneering element to him. I don't know if he was aware of that at the time, but the other pros recognized what he had done. So his life was spent in the sanatorium, fairly benign existence. His sisters, Gertrude and Alice, come to visit him. He'd go out and play a few holes of golf at a local club where, he was very quiet, very unassuming. It's funny because he was this very, very cocky figure, some would say. But then later on, he would come to a club. There was no fanfare. He wasn't sort of turning up in a, expecting everybody to roll out the red carpet for him. He just wanted to play a few holes and stay in touch with the game, and he would go to watch if there was a golf tournament in the area. He would go to watch it. But he died then in 1971 peacefully, just after the U.S. Open at Marion in Philadelphia, where Lee Trevino beat Jack Nicklaus in a playoff. He was at that U.S. Open, so that was a life. It was a long time to spend in a sanatorium, 1916 to 1971, long, long time. The book that I've written about him, it's beyond the remit of the book for me, a layman, to offer a medical analysis of what happened to him. But certainly the loss of investments. One other thing, Fred, that I must mention, actually, that I think possibly affected him too, would affect many of us. In 1914, he went to try and play in the Open Championship. This was his last attempt. It was over in Prestwick on the west coast of Scotland. He failed to show because he misjudged his time, and he was disqualified. He accepted the gracious. He said no. He said no excuse. They wanted to make some sort of an exception for him because of who he was. He said no. I messed up here. My mistake. And on the way back, he was getting in the English Channel, the ship he was sailing on was struck by a British ship, an accident, of course. And he spent the best part of 12 or 15 hours in a lifeboat. And I think for a guy who was in a fairly fragile state of mind, this could have been a terrible shock, as you can imagine. So that didn't help as well. And that might have contributed to the mental illness too. So he was lucky to survive that. Yeah.
And then he had to go play golf after that, going through that?
Well, he went back to America after that. This was on the way home. He was supposed to play in the Open at Prestwick, but missed his time because he was late for whatever reason, misjudgments or something. But on the way home, he was on this, I think it was a German ship, sailing back to America, and they were struck by a British, I think it was a grain container liner, something of that nature. And I think that shook him badly, as it would, because he was all these hours in a lifeboat. He survived, but that was another reason. But I think the most common description of his illness was schizophrenia, which, of course, symptoms of that, as I understand it, are things like hallucinations or imagining that maybe people are out to get you, and he definitely had an element of that. But all that, or aside from all of that, it always struck me in reading about him that he had a relatively peaceful existence in the sanatorium. He was able to get out. It wasn't as if he was being locked away there. It was a quite liberal establishment insofar as any of these places can be, I guess. He was able to get out and play golf. His sisters would come and collect him. He was a devout Roman Catholic. That was very, very strong throughout his career. They would collect him and take him to Mass on Sundays. So a very complex guy. Some strange parts to his personality, but also some generous and kind parts as well. So that's that more or less the picture.
Was there any history of schizophrenia or mental health issues in his family before this that's documented?
I never came across anything to suggest that. I know his mother mm-hmm. looked after him. She was the one who put him to the sanatorium. He was well looked at. He had good family. But I don't think there was any history. Certainly sisters seem to be, one was a unmarried, one was a married and was a widow. Though I don't think there was anything of that nature at all. There's certainly no record that I came across.
But he spent 55 years institutionalized.
Yes, 55 wow. years institutionalized. This was at one stage the top golfer, you know, and there we are.
It's an amazing story, and the kind of story that is important today. I think it really great that you're bringing this out now, and hopefully somebody will recognize it. Maybe we'll get to see the movie someday.
Oh, I doubt it very much, but it would be nice. But it's just lovely to have done it, and it's lovely to get the chance to talk about it, because I think it is an important story, because we tend, as you were alluding to earlier on, golf now, wall-to-wall coverage, massive amounts of money, massive amounts of fame and fortune and everything else. And, you know, two Open Championships in a row, US Open Championships in a row, that's at 19 and 20 years old. That takes some doing. And then this sadness.
Yeah, it's remarkable just in that sense alone. But the fact that he was the first one ever to do it, that nobody else had ever, American born.
He was the first homebred to do it. And the newspapers made a great deal. They were so, as I said, they had this mixed relationship with him. And while they would be critical and they'd report on the fact that maybe he said something he shouldn't have said, which he did on more than one occasion, but they would say, you know, the homebred caddy boy beats the invaders and beats the whoever else it is, the foreign imports and so on. They were quite proud of that, on the other hand, as well. And he did it.
Fascinating story. Yeah. Fascinating story. Kevin, I really appreciate your time. Again, let's go over your books. I'm going to give you the titles. And these are all available on Amazon, I'm hoping?
On Amazon, yes, indeed, yeah. The
Fabulous. American... Well, the book we're talking about is... Golf's Forgotten Hero, The Life of John McDermott.
Yeah.
Then there's also...
The life story of Ralph Guldal, twice U.S. Open champion.
Guldal is Guldahl, and it's the rise and fall of world's greatest golfer.
That's right, exactly. And Patty Berg, pioneer champion of women's golf. And American Golf in the Great Depression. That's the first one I wrote. That basically charts how the tour grew paradoxically in the Great Depression, when so much else was going or was difficult in American society, but professional golf got off the ground really in the 1930s. So that's
I'm fascinated by that one. Absolutely. American Golf in the Great Depression, the pros take to the Grapefruit Circuit.
Grapefruit Circuit, that's what a lot of the swing was down in Florida, among the palm trees and the orange trees and all the rest of it. Yeah.
Mm. Well, Kevin, thank you so much for sharing this story with us and for writing the story. It's a great read, and it's a great read right at this time of year.
Lovely talking to you, Fred.
Thanks to Rich Weil from Somers, New York, who introduced today's episode and actually has been sending me a lot of really compelling emails regarding what he's been learning on Golf Smarter. And today I'm doing an interview for an upcoming episode with instructor Eric Schulberg to address his latest question in regards to what are we thinking about when we make our swing? When I addressed Eric, he's like, I am so into that topic. Let's do it. And you'll be hearing that in the next couple of weeks. And as we learned last week, you too can become a Golf Smarter ambassador and introduce an upcoming episode. And for your effort, you'll receive a glove and glove storage compartment from RedRoosterGolf.com, where you can choose from 11 styles of gloves in 26 sizes so that they fit you properly. We thank RedRoosterGolf.com for giving a new glove to every Golf Smarter ambassador who joins us. And I invite you to also do the same just for leaving a voicemail. Write to GolfSmarterPodcast@gmail.com or click on the Hey Fred button at GolfSmarter.com and let me know that you'd like to do an episode intro, and I'll send you some simple instructions. Now, as for today's conversation, you may not realize this, but as of yet, John McDermott has not been inducted into the World Golf Hall of Fame. Many of the greats have been honored globally, and even Bing Crosby and Bob Hope have been inducted for their contributions to sponsoring golf tournaments. But the man who was the first homebred to win the U.S. Open has been overlooked so far. And considering the forgotten status of John McDermott, it isn't surprising. Again, the book, Golf's Forgotten Hero, The Life of John McDermott, is available on Amazon, written by Kevin Kenney, our guest today. I'll leave a link in today's show notes. If you have any questions, comments, or suggestions for upcoming episodes or ideas for episodes, please click on the Hey Fred button at golfsmarter.com.